Have you embraced the wellness phenomenon? So do you diligently consume your nourish bowl every night before an hour of mindful meditation and follow your early morning structural integration workout with a kale smoothie? Today, wellness is most definitely a thing. But does it work, and what's it really about? Your views welcome via the Life Matters Facebook page. Andre Spicer is Professor of Organisational Behaviour at City University London and co-author of The Wellness Syndrome. Right now, he's on the Gold Coast trying to have a nourishing holiday and joins us on the phone. Andre, welcome.
Hi there.
Now, why did you start looking into wellness, Andre, as a kind of life-fixing concept?
Well, I was struck by the fact that everyone around me suddenly seemed to become obsessed with their own personal wellness. So people would come into work and begin bragging about the 6 a.m. jog that they'd been on, or after work you'd say, what are you up to? And they wouldn't say, I'm off down the pub. They would say, I'm off to do a mindful meditation. Dinner table conversation became quinoa and kale smoothies rather than what was happening in politics. So we wanted to begin to understand why it was that people had suddenly become so obsessed with their own personal wellness and the effect that that was having on people's lives and society more generally.
Well, health and fitness do matter. So what's the problem as you see it with wellness?
Well, I always get suspicious when we're told that something is unproblematically good. This is something which is always great for everyone. But I was sort of struck by the fact that often health and fitness, we all know that, you know, you need to move your body a little bit and eat healthily. But the fact that people had suddenly started to become concerned, worried, or even stressed out about their own wellness. So the idea behind wellness is that it's supposed to improve your life quality. But in many cases, the people I knew and people we were speaking to seemed to say begin talking about their own personal wellness, and it seemed to trigger a sense of guilt and anxiety within them. So this is what we wanted to begin to explore, this dark underside of wellness, which often is not talked about.
Well, in Life Matters, we do often talk about ways and means to health and fitness. That could, I suppose, come under the rubric of wellness. But we do also kind of try to take a sceptical or at least inquiring approach. Tell us, Andre, a little bit about some of the work that's inspired and informed your own thinking on this.
Sure. So when we began this project, myself and my co-author Carl Sederstrom came across a book by a Slovenian philosopher called Alenka Zupančič. And what she talks about, there was one word in this book which was really intriguing. The word was biomorality. And she defined biomorality as this idea that a morally good person is someone who's healthy, happy, and fit. So what seemed to be going on here is this is what philosophers call a category mistake, where you're confusing one category of things with another. So you're confusing this idea of being healthy, happy, and fit with being a morally good person. So you can see this all the time today, where we see someone who's maybe a little bit overweight or doesn't work out as much as they should do or is smoking cigarettes, and we think that that's a morally bad person. It's an unethical person. So we're kind of confusing the sense of moral goodness with the sense of being healthy, happy, and fit. And we wanted to understand kind of what effects that was having both on society more generally, but also on individuals.
So wellness is then, as you're saying, ideological. How is it different, though? Is it different from an earlier concept about self-help?
Yeah, in many ways, wellness trend is kind of a repackaging of self-help culture. So self-help culture, you know, it's been around in the US for, since at least the early 20th century and perhaps before. And it's kind of made comebacks. But wellness is kind of a repackaging, which has at least come, I guess, has its roots back in the 1960s or 1970s. And it's a new way in which self-help culture has been kind of repackaged and reconsumed. So instead of talking about, you know, imagining you can be rich and it will suddenly make you rich, now wellness is very much focused on, you know, basically the components of health and happiness in one's body. And the interesting thing is that it's a repackaging of self-help, which is targeted 70% of the consumers of the wellness industries, which is a $10 billion a year industry in the US, are women. So it's a largely an industry which is largely targeted at women, which is kind of interesting. It gives a different kind of gender dynamic. So it's no longer a question about just having to worry about, you know, many of the things which in women's lives, but now they also have to worry about their wellness levels as well.
I wonder too how much the wellness phenomenon is about a kind of self-denial, you know, in a similar way to religions where abstinence and self-punishment are seen as paths to purity and to redemption.
Mm. It's really interesting that you raise this point, the links between wellness and religion, because if you begin to look at, you strip away the ideology or the kind of set of ideas and you look at the practices and rituals, you begin to see that wellness has very similar kind of practices and rituals to what you would find in a religion. So simply look at what happens on Sunday morning. So instead of going to church, you go and run your 10K run, and then you boast about your good deeds, and you get the sense of moral absolution. You know, maybe you've been a bit naughty the night before, but you can get moral absolution through working out or doing some mindfulness. And it also triggers that, as religions had triggered the sense of guilt, often had thrived on guilt, the same thing with the wellness industries. It kind of works through guilt and then triggering the sense of self-control, people having to have this sort of need to control their habits, their behaviors, and also even their mindsets. So people become guilty, oh, I'm not thinking in a way which maximizes my happiness, bad, 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 I need to change this. You don't go to your priest for absolution anymore, you go for your life coach, and that they can help you out.
There is, I think, certainly a sense of after you've exercised, if you've, you know, eaten well, a certain sense of virtuousness that seems to derive from that, yeah.
Very much so, very much so. And the fact is that we need to show this virtuousness. So no longer do you just buy a pew in your local church, but you post these things onto Instagram and you show the kind of well-being which you're exuding through your lifestyle, and it sort of gets bragged to everyone. So in many ways it kind of becomes a well-being bragging, seems to be a kind of this kind of phenomenon. So often you get a rather false image of the extent of this in some people's lives.
Well, wellness culture also requires a kind of relentless attention to the self, I think. I mean, are we monitoring ourselves too much now according to that sort of wellness maxim?
Yeah. So the interesting thing is that we've, one of the biggest kind of new devices which we see are things like these step counters. All of Apple's new innovations are largely targeted around health and monitoring your own body and your mindset. So we spend a huge amount of our time and day now kind of keeping a track of our own, you know, our own inside. So in some ways, it's no longer just taking a selfie of your face. It's like a selfie of, you know, your body, your DNA. You can do DNA, personalized DNA tests, blood tests to show how, you know, you're monitoring to how well you are. And then the sense of self-monitoring becomes a new job almost that many people take up. And the interesting thing is that sometimes this is even associated with employment, right? So we came across one hedge fund in London where the traders working in that hedge fund had to wear these tracking devices which track their steps and also what they ate, how much sleep they got. And then the firm would correlate that against the traders' trading patterns to see what effect their kind of things they were doing outside of work was having on their work inside the organization. And this went even further. We found one water company, so a municipal water company in Sweden, where you didn't get paid if you didn't go to the gym twice a week. And the company would actually hand out cards where you'd have to swipe in. And the HR office actually got to see how long that you'd spent in the company gym.
Wow. It's Amanda Smith with you, and Andre Spicer is my guest here in Life Matters. He's co-author of The Wellness Syndrome and Professor of Organisational Behaviour at City University London, joining us on the phone. And your thoughts on wellness are very welcome. Is wellness becoming a bit cult-like, do you reckon? Do you feel it takes that moral high ground, or is it a very helpful guide to leading a healthier, happier life for you? Let's know on Facebook. So, Andre, you're talking really about the pressure to embrace wellness being something that's not just an individual or personal thing, but also extending into the professional realm.
Indeed. So many corporations and public sector organizations today have begun to develop corporate wellness programs. So in many ways, these wellness programs are innocuous, right? So what's wrong with offering your company gym or maybe offering fruit and vegetables at work? It sounds great. And in some ways, that's fine. But it seems that many companies are taking this further. So I've just mentioned cases where companies are forcing their employees to go to the gym or else you don't get paid. But it operates also in more subtle ways. So for instance, there was a study which was done recently where they were looking at whether you'd hire someone who's like mildly overweight or someone who's super skinny and has sports and so forth. And guess what? There seemed to be quite a lot of discrimination based on the basis of just even small amounts of body weight. And this has had an effect then on corporate leaders. So in the last, I think, 5 or 10 years, the number of CEOs who brag about running a marathon on their CV has doubled. So it seems that it's no longer good enough just to say, okay, I have this and that experience in industry and I'm a great leader. You have to say, well, I can also climb up a mountain and sleep on it overnight and then run an ultra marathon afterwards and get to work after this and then do my work. So again, we're seeing this idea that performance in terms of your wellness gets mistaken for other things, which is whether you're good at running a company or good at doing your job somehow gets mistaken in terms of your level of health and wellness.
And the US military has taken up mindfulness. Yeah.
Yes. So one of the more surreal things which we came across was an exercise where members of camp, I think it's Camp Pendleton, which is in California, would be given mindfulness practice and then thrown into a fake Iraqi village where there's fake gunshots and so forth, and they were forced to go in there and begin meditating while they were getting assaulted with fake bombs and all these kind of things. So it seemed to be this confusion of mindfulness and then putting this into this most bizarre setting, which is a war zone. And I've also seen this in government organisations in the UK. So I remember coming across one who ran a large department in the UK public service, and she'd been off on long-term stress leave and discovered mindfulness really helped her to deal with depression, which is great, and there's lots of evidence to show that it's good for dealing with individual anxiety and so forth. So then she came back from this and instituted a weekly mindfulness exercise where her team would gather and do some mindfulness after work. Now, that was great for individuals, but it had the effect of then extending the work day. And this seems to be what many companies are doing. They've basically made the workplace and workplace processes more and more mindless over time, and then they try and put this little sticking plaster over it, which is a mindfulness practice after work. But if you actually look at, if you really wanted to make the workplace more mindful, there's some really simple things you'd do. You'd basically say to people, okay, allow yourself a period of time, whether it's an hour or 30 minutes, just to be able to focus on a task and not be distracted by incoming emails, meetings, and other forms of corporate mindlessness, which people are constantly bombarded with. And then guess what? People's well-being in the workplace goes up. So if you actually want to address well-being in the workplace, you don't do it by offering a mindfulness course after work. You do it by looking at people's work processes and allowing them to actually have a process where they're able to begin and then finish a piece of work without being constantly distracted and also having a sense of chronic insecurity hanging over them.
Well, this cultural and or professional demand to embrace wellness can, well, at its worst, I guess, feel sort of tyrannical or at least just a bit silly. What impact do you think it has on us?
Well, I think it can have two impacts it can have. So there's the obvious good stuff. We all know that it will, you know, make you feel better about yourself, potentially maybe make you a little bit smug. But I think there's also a couple of unrecognized things. One, it can become a kind of a new source of anxiety. So people begin to worry that they're not well enough, that they're not happy enough. They begin actually saying, how happy am I really? How well am I really? And there seems to be a lot of evidence which suggests that if you begin asking these questions and being constantly worried about your wellness levels, it actually decreases wellness. So let me give you an example from a study which was done on happiness. They basically got two groups of people, and one group was sort of was given a pretest to see their kind of base level happiness, and then same with the other group. And then one group was showing something which normally makes people happy. This was in the US, and apparently someone winning a figure skating event, a video of that would make them happy. And the other group was showing the same video. But the big difference is one group was told, okay, before this you have to recite, being happy is really important for my life. I strive in all ways to make myself happy and make the most of all moments. The other group said nothing, and then they tested afterwards watching this video, are they more happy or not? And they found that the group had said these happiness is really important aphorisms actually became less happy after watching this video. So the lesson from this is that when we go around saying wellness is so important to me, I must strive to maximize my wellness or happiness or whatever, you actually end up getting less of it than you would expect. So you often miss the surprising little pieces of joy which actually contribute to your happiness or actually might build your wellness during the day.
So what do you think then, what's the antidote to that? And, you know, is there a backlash?
Yeah, the interesting thing is that there has been a lot of wellness backlash in the last, you know, few years. Now, you can find this by just going down to your local cafe. One of the fastest growing kind of food categories you find is not just your quinoa and health foods, but it's also the opposite of that. So burgers,
dude food.
Chips, dude food. It seems to be everywhere, right? So it's at the same time we seem to spend all our time talking about wellness and happiness, this incredibly fatty food, huge, large plates of it seem to be spreading at the same time. So it seems that we want, you know, one side and the other. So that's one backlash. Now, interestingly, on the kind of philosophical level, the other backlash which seems to have come, to sort of the evolution, I suppose, which seems to be coming around this, is this movement away from a focus on wellness and happiness towards the idea of meaningfulness. So I think in the next few years, this will stop talking so much about trying to increase your happiness rating and start beginning talking about the idea of finding meaning in your life. The final thing which I'd say, which is really interesting, and myself and my co-author Carl Cederstrom have really spent the last year trying to explore this in some ways, is the rise of what we'd call neo-stoicism. So a lot of ideas about wellness were built around Epicureanism, so this idea of being happy in life is good. But it seems that there's been this rise of new forms of kind of self-improvement experts, like people like Tim Ferriss, who wrote this book called The 4-Hour Workweek, which are trying to design this kind of wellness culture, which is targeted more at men. So it's more about like how can you go and sit and on ice for 5 hours and then run, you know, like this kind of getting over your any sense of pain or getting over any sense of being able to endure through almost anything and developing, you know, this strong life through it. So I think we're going to begin to see this kind of spread of senses of this idea of this neo-stoicism, kind of fight club stoicism, you might call it, will be a new trend coming soon.
I look forward to developing trends in neo-stoicism. Andre Spicer is the co-author of The Wellness Syndrome and Professor of Organisational Behaviour at the Cass Business School at City University London, currently in Australia, holidaying on the Gold Coast. Andre, I think I need to let you get back to the beach. Thank you for joining us here in Life Matters.
Thank you very much.
This is RN, on air, online, and on your ABC radio app. I'm Amanda Smith.